Podcast.
Listen to The Organist, the culturally omnivorous, intellectually ravenous podcast from the editors of The Believer magazine.
Part of poetry is learning how to speak.
Chilly Billy, Chilly Billy.
I am also a horse.
I really value my life, even though I know it's debatable whether I'm even really alive.
The right reading for this is the one I'm giving you.
Find The Organist on KCRW.com or wherever you download podcasts.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt. And welcome to Bookworm. Today I have a very special show. The biographer, A. Scott Berg, who's written many highly regarded and well-awarded biographies of Lindbergh, of Samuel Goldwyn, wrote, when he was in his 20s, a biography of the editor Max Perkins. The book is called Max Perkins, Editor of Genius. It won that year's 1978 National Book Award. Now there's a film called Genius. It's based on the relationship between Maxwell Perkins and Thomas Wolfe. Thomas Wolfe, the author of Look Homeward, Angel, of Time in the River, You Can't Go Home Again. But Perkins was also the editor and discoverer of F. Scott Fitzgerald, of Hemingway. He edited The Yearling, which won the Pulitzer Prize that year. He was really publishers' great bad boy, bringing in books that publishers didn't want, were afraid of. He had to defend them. He was opening literature to a new language, a new sensibility, and every time he'd bring one of these boys in, he would have to have a huge fight to defend them. Now, this week, the movie Genius, which stars, who are they?
It stars Colin Firth as Maxwell Perkins, and Jude Law as Thomas Wolfe, and Aline Bernstein, who is Thomas Wolfe's lover, is played by Nicole Kidman.
And they're all terrific.
Thomas Wolfe was a genius. He was almost a word machine, except I don't want to take away the artistry from what he did. But this was a man from whom words just poured. He was 6'5", was from the South. Everything about him was oversized. His emotions, his appetites, his drinking. And as a result of that, he was just torrential. And now he comes up against Maxwell Perkins, who was a Yankee, a New Yorker and Vermonter, Harvard educated, who was all about structure, all about duty, all about serving literature.
Sparse of speech, he used Maxwell's silver hammer to whittle a manuscript down and bring it into shape.
He definitely did that. And this was the ultimate challenge for each man, actually, that here's Perkins facing this great torrent of words, and here's Wolfe facing somebody who keeps putting dams up wherever the water is flowing.
Wolfe was so tall that when he was writing at full stream, he used to stand by his refrigerator and write on the refrigerator top.
Literally, he would stand there with a ream of paper, and there was a wooden crate at the foot of the refrigerator, and he would just sit there and scribble in pencil, sometimes 20 words to a page, and just throw the pages into a box, and he never reread them. Every now and then, Perkins would make him bring in the next crate of words. And that's what it was, a crate of words.
And Perkins saw, in the same way that he heard an original sound in F. Scott Fitzgerald, a sound that defined a generation, eventually known as the Jazz Age, found in Hemingway another kind of voice that had never been heard before. And now, remember, you know, this is pre-Faulkner. The Southern Torrent was unknown, and Max Perkins, the editor of Genius, found it. Now, they developed a relationship depicted in the movie Genius that was truly a father-son relationship, so that the story of their writing professional friendship was also a personal friendship and was also implicitly the story of what Wolfe was doing in his novel of Time in the River, searching for a father. The father theme is crucial to what Wolfe was doing, and Maxwell Perkins, his editor, became his father figure, yes?
I think there's no question about that, and you've struck on the main theme in Wolfe's literature. He often talked about his search for a father. Now I should throw in, Maxwell Perkins always wanted to have a son. He had a somewhat fractious marriage to a rather talented and somewhat undisciplined wife, but they had five daughters. And clearly, Perkins kept trying for the son, but after the fifth daughter, they had no more children. But he's adopting these sons all the time, his literary sons. Maxwell Perkins really changed the job of book editing.
Absolutely.
Before Max Perkins, the job of an editor was a fairly mechanical one. It was really just preparing an author's manuscript for the typesetter. With Perkins, it was quite different. He did get personally involved with each of his authors, and he realized that the time an author needed an editor most was not really when the book was finished. It was often the whole process of getting the book finished. And so there we see, well, in the book, and you see it in the film as well, you see Max Perkins serving as a marriage counselor, as a psychiatrist, as a money lender. I mean, there's one extremely touching scene in the movie where F. Scott Fitzgerald's in his seventh year trying to complete Tender as the Night, comes begging for more advance money. And Perkins explains he just can't do it. He can't justify it on the company books. And quietly, as Fitzgerald is pouring out his heart, Perkins just goes to his own wallet and pulls out his checkbook and writes a check.
Now, as often as not, it wasn't just that he was looking for them. They were coming to him. He was the editor of Hemingway, of The Sun Also Rises, of all the major work. He edited The Great Gatsby, although it was a notorious flop. We think of it as one of the great works of American literature. Scribner's thought of it as a money pit.
Yes, and we should go back 5 years before Gatsby, even. With the publication of This Side of Paradise in 1920, it not only put F. Scott Fitzgerald on the map, and I try to explain to people the impact that book had on American culture at that time, and the closest thing I can get to it is Catcher in the Rye. This was the book every young American was reading and wanted to be like and wanted to write like, really influenced things. So in taking a chance on Fitzgerald's first book, This Side of Paradise, it not only put Fitzgerald on the map, in turn, it put Perkins on the map. It made him, in literary circles anyway, rather well known. And that's what helped attract Hemingway. And now Hemingway becomes a huge hit with The Sun Also Rises. And so by the end of the 1920s, Maxwell Perkins was the only editor who had any name. I mean, he had a reputation. Indeed, it wasn't beyond the literary world, but anybody who wanted to be a published author knew that name. And one of them was Thomas Wolfe, who came to the big city with his big sprawling Southern novel, Look Homeward, Angel.
I'm talking to A. Scott Berg, Scott Berg, the author of Max Perkins, editor of Genius. Fortunately, the book is available in paperback. It's a really fascinating read. I spent the last week gobbling it down. But A movie needs to emphasize its dramatic elements, and Aileen Bernstein is central to it because, as you comment, she loves when she loves 200%. And this is a very dependent relationship, and she grows jealous of the time that Thomas Wolfe spends with Maxwell Perkins.
I'd go even farther than that. I think she became jealous not just of the time, but of the emotion. And I think Aileen Bernstein, who had had an affair for several years with Thomas Wolfe at this point, realized that from the moment Max Perkins entered Tom's life, he had become the muse. And now Tom was writing for Max, no longer writing for Aileen. And I think this really freaked her out.
Freaked her out, and, you see, she was very, very fearful, as many people are. The next book would have been the book about Thomas Wolfe's relationship with Aileen, and she was terrified by the prospect of not only reading about herself, but having others read about her. I don't know how many people have been in this situation, but it's very frightening to be written about by someone who loves you so much that he hates you.
Well, I think there's truth to that. And I think we have to go back to the basic adage of Thomas Wolfe's life and work, and it's something he often said: all serious work in fiction is autobiographical. And indeed, in the first drafts of what became Look Homeward Angel, before Max Perkins really pulled it all together, the names of the characters were the actual names of the family members in Thomas Wolfe's home. I mean, the people in the town all had their real names, and they got changed. That was his way of fictionalizing. So you're absolutely right. Aileen knew this, that Tom was catching up to their love affair. That would be the next big thing he would write about. And I should hasten to add here, you know, Aileen was still married. She had two children, so she worried about that too.
And she was involved in the theatrical world. She was perhaps the premier designer of costumes. So talk about her, would go through the world of theater and culture like wildfire. Eventually, Look Homeward, Angel caused the people in the town that he came from, what was its name?
Asheville, North Carolina.
To reject him. He came home expecting the homecoming of a hero because of the great reviews, the astonished words about his first book, and instead encountered a community furious.
They were ready to stone him. I mean, it was here you've given away all the town's secrets. You've told the story of the town doctor. You told the story of the town lawyer. And they were furious.
Now, let's talk a bit about autobiography, because right now, I think everyone listening is reading or hearing about the work of Karl Ove Knausgård. And he has given, in what will be finally five volumes, a practically day-by-day history of life. There's a good 20 pages, brilliantly written, about diapering and re-diapering and diapering and re-diapering the baby. Now, Knausgård is a modern writer. That is to say, he is rather dry. He's not an emotional extremist. He's not a romanticist. But I think that he is a descendant of Thomas Wolfe.
I think you're exactly right about this, and I think Wolfe is definitely his forefather. They have the same impetus and the same goal, I think, which is to take the quotidian and universalize it. So the re-diapering, well, what, that is a universal family occupation. So that's what Wolfe certainly saw. Now the question becomes, is Knausgård on a par with Wolfe? Does he have the same literary gifts, the same language at his disposal, the same rhythms. Wolfe was also obsessed with great American themes, and he just fills his book with Americana everywhere. So there's that. And then you move on to the other big question, which is, how does he function with his editor? Because I think writers like this do need editors. Again, they need dams to wall back some of the water.
It's interesting. I had the privilege of talking to Carl Ove Nausgaard's editor, who told the story of Nausgaard calling him daily at nighttime to read what he had written during the day. This is so similar to the impulse of Thomas Wolfe. Wolfe was a little bit more selfish. He wanted to send the material, if at all, 500 pages at a time in big chunks. And Wolfe really edited it down into manageable units. Sentences that were hundreds of words long became 7 words long. Whereas Knausgaard today, we allow those flowing sentences that take many, many pages and paragraphs that last for 20, 30, 40 pages at a time. It's a whole new realm of writing.
I agree. And you actually raise, Michael, a really interesting artistic slash literary question. The screenwriter, John Logan, actually poses this in the film.
The film is Genius, which is about the relationship between Max Perkins and Thomas Wolfe.
Exactly, in which Colin Firth, as Max Perkins, says, you know, what keeps editors awake at night is, are we making books better or are we just making them different? And the question has arisen over the years, especially with the publication of the original version of what was Le Comward Angel, a book called Oh Lost originally. And the question is, should Wolfe have been published in his original form without making Thomas Wolfe conform to the modern perimeters that we put on novels?
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with A. Scott Berg about his book, Max Perkins, Editor of Genius, which is the basis for the movie opening this week, Genius, about the relationship between the editor, Maxwell Perkins, and Thomas Wolfe. We'll continue after this short break.
Listen to the Rhythm Planet podcast to explore music from all corners of the globe, Brazilian, European, African, and tropical Latin. Rhythm Planet is a state of mind. Listen at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet or on KCRW's app.
This is Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and I'm talking with A. Scott Berg, about his book, Max Perkins, Editor of Genius, a book that was originally published in, I believe, 1978, won the National Book Award, and is fascinating still. The story of the intimate relationship between notable authors Fitzgerald, Hemingway, Thomas Wolfe, and their editor. Now, this question, are the works of writers that were substantially edited, what are we to regard as the permanent work? When I read the complete version or the completer version of Dreiser's Sister Carrie, it was unquestionably to me a better book than the book that I'd read when I was in college. And in part, it's because it was edited to be less scandalous than Dreiser had originally intended. The publisher was, like Scribner's, conservative. I think in the case of Thomas Wolfe, for me, it's definitely true that what Max Perkins did was a favor to Thomas Wolfe. I've been reading Oh Lost. It's been put together by the couple who've been working on F. Scott Fitzgerald's papers and manuscripts. And of course, they have something at stake. They want to say, this is the book. Ours is the book. But in the case of Wolfe, he really did have, would you say, a genius?
I think there's no question about it. I think both men had genius. I think Wolfe, as a man who put words on paper, had a genius, and I think Perkins himself was a genius. He could see through it. He could see an actual novel within this box of words that would periodically get delivered. So yes, I think there's a vast improvement. And I should also add this. Max Perkins's own watchwords were, the book belongs to the author. Maxwell Perkins never made Thomas Wolfe do a single thing. Every choice that was made in that book was made by Thomas Wolfe. Now, they were very good suggestions, and here was a young 28, 29-year-old author now sitting with the editor who had made literary giants already of F. Scott Fitzgerald and Ernest Hemingway, and there was a whole raft of other writers he was already working with, and as you pointed out, moved on to work with Marjorie Kinnan Rawlings and Alan Payton and James Jones. I mean, it's an endless list. All that being said, Perkins made it very clear, Tom, I'm giving you suggestions. I think they're very good suggestions. And by and large, Wolfe did heed them. But a certain part of him, of course, did resent Perkins for that. And ultimately, in fact, Wolfe himself so publicly acknowledged the work that Perkins had done.
He dedicates the second book to Maxwell Perkins.
He does, with a very lavish paragraph of an acknowledgement.
I mean, this was your first book.
It was.
But subsequently, how do you choose whose stories you'll tell? Does genius especially appeal to you?
Well, this I found when I was a college student, and I had such a passion for F. Scott Fitzgerald. That was the primary reason I went off to his alma mater, which was Princeton, which is where I found all Fitzgerald's papers, and then in going through them, discovered Max Perkins popping up everywhere and began to go through Perkins's papers, most of which had just been donated to the Princeton Library. While I was working on this book, I mean, again, it was my first book, I guess by the time I was about 23, I began to think, I'm having a very good time. I really don't want to go to law school. I'll do almost anything not to go to law school, even write this book. But beyond this book, I began to think, wouldn't it be interesting to write a shelf full of books? Not just one biography, but what about five or six biographies? And then I thought each of my subjects could be 20th century American cultural figures. Each one might come from a different wedge of the apple pie, a different part of the country. And basically, that's what I've been doing for the last, 40-odd years.
And this book, Max Perkins, Editor of Genius, by my guest A. Scott Berg, this book, after you had a draft as an undergraduate, took you 7 years more.
Correct.
To complete. How long in general does it take to write a fully considered biography?
Well, it takes me, and I think it takes that handful of the writers we consider America's serious storytellers, the biographers. It usually takes anywhere from 7 to 12 years, I'd say.
Wow. What accounts do you think for the fact that Wolfe, once really considered to be surely one of the canon of America's great writers, he's more or less disappeared?
Yeah, he has. And it's a little sad and somewhat ironic in some ways. This was the most American voice since Whitman. This was somebody everybody knew. I think as a result, what happened is we had at least a generation of really bad imitators of Thomas Wolfe. Every 19-year-old with a thought in his head or with a baby that needed re-diapering suddenly thought, oh, Thomas Wolfe, I'll do it the way he did it. And I'll just...
I'll buy a big refrigerator.
I'll buy a big refrigerator and a crate and just spew. And maybe a lot of it could have been good literature had there been a Max Perkins standing by, I should add. But as a result of that, over by the 40s and 50s, people were getting really tired of this Wolfian writing. And I think he was now being pulled off of syllabi in colleges. And today he's almost not read at all. And I think it's a real crime, because I think anybody who is young and passionate and romantic and just has a real love of language will find a lot to admire in Thomas Wolfe.
Someone who hasn't read Look Homeward, Angel doesn't know really what it's like in prose to get really, really drunk and sing and yodel and perform arias. It's really a first-person fantasia of self-discovery. There's nothing like it.
No, there isn't. Although I hate to think you're now encouraging yodeling on the streets, but but we should be encouraging a look at Thomas Wolfe, I think. You know, somebody once asked Max Perkins, do you think Thomas Wolfe will always be read? And he said, well, I think as long as there are sophomores in college. And I think there's truth to that. And I was 19 years old when I first read Thomas Wolfe. And I'll tell you what I think Wolfe also has. And that is passion. And for a young reader especially, finding himself, for Wolfe finding himself in his books, and even for what Perkins did with Wolfe, it's all about the passion, the love of the word, the love of the book.
I've been talking with A. Scott Berg, the author of Max Perkins, Editor of Genius. It's now available in paperback. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you very much, Michael. Always a pleasure. Passion.
The occasion for this conversation is the brand new film, Genius, that stars Jude Law and Colin Firth. It's opening this week and will be opening and opening around the country. And unique in films, it's about the relationship of an editor and a writer. You can comment on today's show at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to my assistant, David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Kate Tempest is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.